It's the new and free Ave Maria Radio app. Search at your app store or go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the app banner.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. I'm very excited about my guest today. His name is Eric Butler, and he's a scholar of European literature. He has been translating all kinds of interesting books, and the one that caught my attention is a recent collection of short stories by the French Catholic writer Léon Bloch, and the title of that book is Disagreeable Tales by Wakefield Press. I'm going to be saying throughout this interview, you must read this book, you must buy this book and read it, because Léon Bloch is a great unsung hero in the history of not just literature, but of Catholic writing and spirituality, and he has a great personal story to tell, and we're going to do all of that during this next hour. Welcome, Eric Butler, to Church and Culture.
Thanks so much for having me, Dale.
Your translation of these 30 stories, and am I correct in saying they were originally published in 1895?
Memory serves. Certainly that's...
Well, it's masterful. I've read all of Bloch that's available in English translation. Most people who know about these things have read The Pilgrim of the Absolute, for example. Mm-hmm. And this is by far the best translation of Bloch that I've ever encountered, and I want to personally thank you for making this available. These are really, I call them great stories with hesitation because they're just so powerful. They're so, in a way, they're hard to read because they're just, each one is like a spiritual exercise for me to read. And
pardon me for interrupting.
Go ahead. Do you think similarly?
Absolutely. It's grueling, and they were certainly intended as such. To quote Bloch's contemporary, Nietzsche, greatness is something that stands beyond good and evil and kind of just imposes itself. Of course, Bloch had moral concerns that the self-professed Antichrist did not.
Exactly. And by the way, let's let our listeners understand what we're saying when we say Bloch. It's spelled B-L-O-Y. Now, explain to us, why is it pronounced Bloch?
Oh, my. Well, I would say in keeping with the rules of French, which, as anyone who's ever tried to learn the language knows, can be pretty arcane.
So the L is sounds like a W?
Well, it just kind of softens in the course of pronunciation, I'd say.
So it becomes a very soft, kind of mushy L?
Yeah. By the same token, in Polish, for example, there's an L sound that winds up sounding like a W most of the time. If you ever see anything written in Polish and used to the Roman character L with the little line through it.
Right.
It's the sound in question. So
we want people to know what they're looking for when they go on Amazon. Léon Bloch, B-L-O-Y, and the book we're talking about is Disagreeable Tales. Before we get into it, you have another Bois translation coming out sometime this year. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, that appeared at around the same time as Disagreeable Tales, and Wakefield will be publishing it under the title Sweating Blood, which is a scriptural reference to the crucifixion. And that is Bois' account of the Franco-Prussian War that he had experienced
firsthand
in his youth. And yes.
He was born in what, 1865? Is that correct?
Excuse me?
He was born in 1865?
He was born in 1846.
46. Tell us a little about his life.
Okay, well, he came from the southwestern region of France, and the story goes he had a very devout mother who was of Spanish extraction and a free-thinking father. And in his younger years, was definitely a cantankerous spirited individual. I believe he was apprenticed to a printer in Paris, and he kicked about sort of in an artistic milieu. He first wanted to be a painter for some time before recognizing, I suppose, the emptiness of it all, and embracing Catholicism, which he did after meeting Barbe d'Aurevilly, who is another underappreciated 19th century author whom, among others, Oscar Wilde and Henry James really appreciated. He has a sort of supernatural cast to much of what he writes, but it's not as, shall we say, grotesque
it's interesting that you use the word grotesque, because as I read these stories, I had the same feeling I have when I read Flannery O'Connor, that I was being turned inside out a little bit.
Yes, I think that's the objective. What's really great, well, about Blois and Flannery O'Connor is that for them, the saints' lives, as it were, do not belong to the past, or rather, what holy men and women experienced long ago can still occur today, but no one really recognizes it for what it is.
And that's because they're looking for stained glass images, correct?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the kind of thing that would be immortalized in a cathedral, really, whether it's the gargoyles or, you know, the beatific, you know, faces of angels. I mean, it's something permanent that belongs to eternity rather than the kind of flux and flow of the modern world.
And Bois, for our listeners, and this is a personal thing for me, he was largely responsible for the conversion to Catholicism of Jacques and Raissa Méritain in the 1910s, before the First World War. He published a novel called The Woman Who Was Poor, which was very highly thought of when it came out, and it came to the Méritain's attention. And Raissa writes in a memoir that when she read The Woman Who Was Poor, she and Jacques felt for the first time that they were facing the reality of Christianity. And they went to meet him. And, of course, he lived in utter poverty. In fact, he had a certain nickname. What was that nickname?
Oh, the Ungrateful Beggar. He's one of them. Because, yeah, he really embraced poverty and made it a point of pride, like, you know, St. Francis or somebody, of olden times, but in the modern world.
So he did not even attempt to live off the sales of his writings. He lived with his hand held out.
Yes, and well, I would say his with his hand held out when he wasn't, you know, brandishing his fist.
Yeah, he
at the same.
Yeah, he was a just a prophetic figure? I mean, because as you read these tales, and they are called disagreeable by, and that's his own name for them. He skewers everybody. Every kind of person who's out there, and he's constantly surprising us by stories that start with pictures of people who, to the world's eyes, are wonderful, happy, virtuous people, but who inside are perhaps harboring secrets of really horrendous secrets, or are motivated not by virtue at all, but by evil intent. And he's, is it true to say that he thought of this as pervasive of humanity?
Well, I think, I of course can't know absolutely, but he was certainly a didactic writer. I mean, he wanted to teach people something, and one way to make a point, of course, is to dramatize things as much as possible. And to this end, I think he really had, you know, what in modern psychological parlance would be called negative obsessions. But the point was to take these aspects of humanity and really bring them to light and show the spiritual stakes, because I think it was very clear to him that the world, including the self-professed Christian world, was not living up to its obligations as per Holy Writ.
We should mention that the new Pope, Pope Francis, in his very first public speech, quoted Léon Boix. He quoted the line that Boix is somewhat famous for: "Whoever does not pray to God prays to the devil." And this is a Pope who's known for his wide acceptance of every kind of person. But yet this particular line is, could you say, pretty black and white?
Yeah, no, and that's one of the interesting paradoxes of Boix's character, or certainly his writing. I mean, on the one hand, he is extremely intolerant and ready to condemn, it seems, anyone for anything. And yet, he has, I think, underlying it, this broad love for humanity and understanding for human foibles. It's just that...
Even more than foibles.
Excuse me?
Even more than foibles.
Even more than foibles. Even vices.
Yeah.
Even vices. He really appreciates fully just how much you know, mankind is in need of redemption, given its, you know, inherently flawed nature.
To give our listeners a little taste of it, why don't you tell the story? A précis of the story about the man who became very wealthy blanching the wood of coffins. He was a coffin maker. That one has a pretty surprise ending.
Yes, well, so this the story in question is, among other things, a polemic against Calvinism and, you know, the idea of an elect group of people predestined for salvation. Our hero, for want of a better word, the protagonist of the story, is a man who who has made a fortune manufacturing coffins, and he decides, based on his own inward faith, which is, of course, you know, a tenet of the Protestant strains of Christianity, he decides that the poor really can't be said to have a soul at all, in as much as they have no worldly possessions. After all, again, as per his beliefs, virtue is rewarded in this lifetime. So he found a charitable society to assist the wealthy who
suffer, he says.
Who suffer from being surrounded by so many unhappy, miserable people who are sort of tainting their earthly beatitude. And it turns out that he's so successful in his efforts that his son, whom he's brought up in the faith, finally comes to view his own father as a bit of an impediment to his own, that is the son's, worldly success. And to make a short story even shorter, and of course it's all about how plot.
And by the way, all of these stories are a maximum of 5 pages long.
Yeah, absolutely. So in a sort of surprising twist at the end, the father and the patriarch of the new but false Jerusalem of Geneva, as it were, gets packed into one of his own coffins and incinerated.
While the son stands there watching, and as it turns out, the father is not dead.
No, he's not dead at all. And you know, here on Earth, where again the those predestined for success can experience heaven, here on Earth, he, whether predestined for this fate or not, can experience the flames of hell.
And so you have this last scene where there's three men standing there as the casket goes into the fire, one of whom's a son, and they hear a beating inside, like something, you know, is moving alive, and the son insists, no, it's just the body, you know, decomposing. And then the very last line is, he could see his father's hand reaching to him from the casket. And then you say it was a parricide. It was the killing of the father.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So what I think is at stake there for Blois is again this lesson in theology. That is that he tries to make by counterexample, by showing how Christianity falsely interpreted really leads to barbarism.
I want to remind our listeners, I'm talking to Eric Butler, who is a translator, a literary scholar. We're going to talk later about some of the books he's written on vampires and an upcoming book on devils in literature and film, which, by the way, I was going to write, but that's okay. But this particular translation is of 30 short stories published in 1895 by Léon Bois, the Catholic writer, who is far overdue for a renaissance and a reevaluation, a reappreciation by not just those who love good literature, but those who value a Catholic writer writing at the highest level of fiction. There's another story, Eric, in here that you translated about a man who is just left his lover, his love of his life, walking down a street of Paris. We know from the narrator that his sister died in a shipwreck and drowned, and he's walking through the streets, and a harlot comes up and whispers provocatively, "Follow me, it won't cost much," and so forth. And he almost goes with her, but then he says, "No, I have to be true to my faith, and you should too." And so this harlot backs off and says, "Thank you for saying that to me." And then he's walking along, and she comes back and offers to lead him through a part of the city where she's afraid he'll get jumped by pimps and so forth. And when they finish this walk, she's, by the way, and the narrator notes that she's clutching his arm very, very tightly, overly tightly. And then they get to the other side where he's safe, and she turns and kisses him very, very hard. And then she says goodbye, and he realizes it's his sister as she throws herself under the wheels of a carriage passing by, and her head is crushed. It was his sister who he thought was dead. That one, I couldn't read another story for a while after reading that story.
Yeah, no, it really is tough. And this, I think, connects with what I was trying to say earlier about Flaw's real compassion, despite all the vitriol that he spews, his real compassion for humanity and the kinds of horrible circumstances that people find themselves in. And here, too, there's a lesson for the ages, which is, you know, as per the biblical phrase, the Lord works in mysterious ways, and we cannot presume to know exactly what we are facing at any given moment or how it fits into a larger plan for either testing us and potentially for, leading to our redemption. Because the main character in this story is clearly an imperfect being himself. He's coming from some kind of dalliance when he walks by this woman. But after this encounter, he winds up becoming a monk. And
yes, he became a monk at the very end. I forgot that. And why do you think that was? I mean, Vaughn never explains why things happen. He just sets down the fact of it, and he leads it up to the reader to decide.
Exactly. I think what he does is he juxtaposes things, and he will show somebody's reaction very often without explaining their motivation, because the motivation can, on the one hand, be psychological, that is to say, comprehensible in human terms, or it can really be an act of grace. There's some kind of spiritual transfiguration.
It's very Flannery O'Connor-like. In fact, Eric, you wouldn't be surprised if over the years I have experienced recommending the stories of Flannery O'Connor to people, and they come back and they don't like them. They're too violent. They're too, dirty to them. And I'm sure that some who read Bois would have the same reaction. I don't say that to discourage people. I think these are very important stories for us to be reading, because they are spiritual exercises. They make you look at yourself.
Yeah, that is certainly the objective. And again, if you're just going back and reading anything in the Bible, of course, what is being described, it is, this real struggle between good and evil in the soul of each and every mortal being. And so in that sense, although it's grueling to read these tales, it's the same kind of exercise that one performs, I think, in reading scripture.
On the redemptive side, it seems to me clear that Bois is also trying to say, and as you say, he can be didactic in places, that there's no redemption, no holiness, no spiritual growth, insight without suffering.
Oh yeah, that is certainly true. I mean, if anything, that would seem to be the sole path to salvation. I mean,
the only path.
Yeah, and I should add, just to qualify my early remarks, when I said that he was didactic, I didn't mean to say that he was didactic in a pedantic sense. But
right.
There always is a moral to the story, even if it's not apparent. But to get back to what you were saying, it's absolutely true that the path to God leads through suffering. For Bois.
I like your line in the introduction where you say, Disagreeable tales proves disagreeable only if one is invested in the depravity it depicts. Yeah, I mean, anybody that goes to this for salacious reasons is going to be very disappointed.
Oh, yeah. No, there's really no way that I'm... I mean, well, here's another paradox. You know, if you're left with a dirty feeling, it's ultimately at least supposed to be cleansing.
Yeah, you say a little later in the same paragraph, the writer means for them these stories to sting and scourge like so many lashes of holy chastisement. By the way, your short introduction, which I wish had been a little longer, was excellent. I think it really does prepare the reader to have some grasp on what would perhaps bewilder them if they didn't have that introduction.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, you know, all I can say is that the spirit moved me. Because, I mean, despite all of the bumps, you know, Bois really is a joy to read, besides being a horror.
The best comparison is even better than Flannery O'Connor is Edgar Allan Poe.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Baudelaire... you know, the generation before Bois, was responsible for translating Poe into French, and it was very, very popular, wasn't it not? Was it not?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, Baudelaire has one of my, I really came to understand his poetry a lot better when I read, either in a letter or an essay he had written, that Edgar Allan Poe and Joseph de Maistre, quote, taught me how to reason, unquote.
Yes.
So this unsparing, rigorous kind of cruelty opened his eyes to some aspects of reality he hadn't fully grasped before. And was very much in that spirit. In fact, in the forthcoming volume, Sweat and Blood, there's a great story called The House of the Devil that actually begins...
Well, hold off. We're going to have a break.
Okay.
And we'll come back to that story. You seem to be preoccupied with devils, given your forthcoming book. We'll talk about that. I'll be back with Eric Butler, translator of Léon Bois' Disagreeable Tales, just after this break.
On the evening of February 25th, 2013, Dr. Peter Kraft spoke to Sacred Heart Major Seminary students and guests about the new evangelism.
How shall we answer our question?
What does the new evangelization need the most? Well, we first should define terms. It's a very useful and helpful thing to do, to define terms, because when you define your terms, you know what you're talking about. And when you don't know what you're talking about, well, you don't know what you're talking about. What is the new evangelization? It is not a new evangel, it is a new ization. It's not a new gospel, it's the old gospel.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Sacred Heart Major Seminary's auditorium was jammed. You won't want to miss Dr. Peter Graft of the seminary on the next Putting On the Mind of Christ. It's heard this and every Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net. on the internet.
This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. All we do in the pro-life movement must be sustained by prayer. That's why a national prayer service will be held on the morning of the March for Life, Friday, January 22nd, in Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. We invite you and your groups to come from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. The host committee includes Dick Bott of Bott Radio Network, Tony Perkins of Family Research Council, Charmaine Yost of Americans United for Life, Brad Mattis of Life Issues Institute, Archbishop Craig Bates, Patriarch of the International Communion of the Charismatic Episcopal Church, and Alan Sears, President and CEO and General Counsel of Alliance Defending Freedom. Key leaders of various denominations will lead prayers, and I will deliver the sermon. The service is a marvelous expression of unity. Please join us and learn more at nationalprayerservice.com. This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
back with Eric Butler, the translator of Léon Bois' Disagreeable Tales. Before the break, you were about to tell us a story that Bois tells in the forthcoming volume that you're translating.
Yes, well, so this is called The House of the Devil, and like Disagreeable Tales, Sweat and Blood is made up of 30 short narratives that are so many slices of life and eternity, as it were, kind of whipped up into one kind of very decadent but at the same time spiritual confection. So The House of the Devil is about a place that has, in the Franco-Prussian War, that has this very sinister and foreboding aspect, and so much so that Edgar Allan Poe couldn't have devised anything more haunting. He starts the story. But nobody can really say what it is that makes the place so unsettling. And, of course, as is always the case, it's in the telling, but it turns out that the house is inhabited by an old woman and a young girl who are just inexpressibly sad. They are just heartbroken. They're so sad because of, you know, the war that's raging around them, and also their lot in life, which was left to them by the world's worst painter. So the haunted habitation that just exudes supernatural terror is filled top to bottom with the worst painting, the worst, most acting and cliched paintings imaginable. And they've endowed it with such sort of metaphysical power that anyone who comes to the door basically winds up dying. And so this is the fate of any number of German soldiers who wind up there in their exploits. But the basic conceit is that there is nothing more pathetic in the sense of pathosly, in the sense of, you know, involving human experience and emotion than attempts to find, then attempts to express all the travails of earthly suffering and failing to do so. So it's as if this very bad painter has unwillingly poisoned an entire an entire sort of corner of the landscape with his.
There is a sense of humor in Bois, isn't there?
I'm sorry?
There is a sense of humor that runs through this.
Yeah, no, there's absolutely a sense of humor, and a very dark humor, but it's the kind of, very often people are surprised to learn that Franz Kafka, you know, would erupt in gales of laughter when sharing some of his stories with his friends. I mean, just to refer to another author who seems to have an unremittingly bleak outlook.
Yeah, I'm wondering, did Bois ever say much about Dostoevsky?
That's a good question.
Because there seems to be a thread of that going through this as well. I'm sure he did. I'm sure he read him.
Yeah, I absolutely. I'm trying to think of a concrete reference, and that's escaping me. But
by the way, I want to quote another story that Jacques Maritain told about Léon Bois. He said that he was talking about many people who are good heathens but want to be assisted by religion on their deathbed are apt to say, and I won't do it in French, but here it is in English, "I don't want to die like a dog." But Bois commented, "I have never understood why a man who lives like a pig does not want to die like a dog."
No, that's exactly it. And in fact, I'm trying to remember the name of the story, but there's a great selection in Disagreeable Tales where a bunch of rich people are hanging out and they resolve to do away with the poor. If you recall that the tale of the prodigal son is invoked there, and as well as the episode in the New Testament where there's demonic possession. And basically, what happens is, if a thousand demons can inhabit a person's body, I can't remember the details.
You can't remember everything. By the way, the filmmaker who comes to mind when I read Bois is Louis Buñuel.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Absolutely.
I don't know why. There's something about the ghostliness of Bois and the iridation of the luminous, both dark luminous and light luminous, that comes to mind. You know, in this story that you translated, The Prisoners of Longjumeau, I hope I pronounced it right, it seems like the writer Samuel Beckett in Waiting for Godot stole the basic theme of Godot from this story. Would you mind telling the story to our listeners?
No, not at all. And in fact, I just remembered what I failed to recall a moment ago, which is that it's not that the prodigal son returns in Bois' reworking. It's that all the pigs he ended.
Now it is Buñuel. It is absolutely Buñuel.
And that, by the way, and I will get to the Prisoners of Longjumeau, of course, but that is the connection to Buñuel, who has lots of these elaborate dinner parties where it's really just the upper crust of society, but they're trapped with each other.
That's it. That's the connection I think I was making in my subconscious.
No, and that, of course, leads, so here, and again, this is totally in keeping with Bois' narrative style, by the way, to go on a digression and then circle back, so justified. That leads to the story you asked about, which is about a young couple that seems, once again, to have found an earthly paradise.
Everyone believes they're the perfect happy couple.
Exactly, and it turns out, however, that they're completely miserable because for years and years they have been trying to get out of town and
trying to travel. They dream of traveling.
They dream of traveling, or even just going maybe 20 miles away to pay respects to a relative who has died.
Like his mother. I mean, a mother-in-law. Also, they never make a dinner party. They never make a wedding. They never make a funeral. They never leave the house, and everyone assumes it's because they're so much in love that they only need each other.
No, and the really, again, the kind of twist that Bois gives to it is that they actually haven't conceived any kind of ill will towards each other. Maybe they are perfectly in love, but what does that amount to when they can't ever get away from each other? So there they are, sort of suspended, mm-hmm. like bugs in amber.
Well, like Dee Dee and Gogo in Waiting for Godot. I mean, they say, and let's go, and then the stage directions is nobody moves.
Right. Right, and of course, the only difference, I guess, is that Dee Dee and Gogo really, will abuse each other and try to come up with insults and so on and so forth.
Well, pass the time.
Yeah, but that same feeling of immobility and paralysis is definitely there. And
what happens to this couple in the end?
Well. In the end, it finally seems that they're going to succeed, but sure enough, I'm trying to remember the exact snag that presents itself.
Well, I have it before me. I'll read it to you. It says,
okay.
They finally got out of the house for a trip. They got on the train, but the train didn't move. Then they got in a car to go home, and it remained at the station. They had to start all over again, and here's the last paragraph. The only voyage they could not possibly miss, evidently, was the one they had just undertaken, alas. In other words, suicide. And the last line is, their character, which is well known, prompts me to believe they readied themselves only in trembling.
That's it. That's it.
There's a lot of suicide in these stories, by the way.
There's a lot of suicide. There's a lot of violent death in general. And on the one hand, that I think can point to martyrdom and the way that a life is transfigured when it's given in sacrifice. But on the other hand, when it is suicide, it's the opposite. It's not a voice. It's not a life that is lifted in meaning, but one that is almost evacuated of it.
Out of desperation, what we've come to fashionably call ennui.
Ennui. If you can conceive boredom, I suppose, as a sort of metaphysical force.
Right. Now the let me take a shot at my sort of takeaways from my first reading of these stories, and that is that Bois insists that all of humanity on the inside is pretty filthy, pretty dirty, and that humanity lives, however, to be seen by others in a certain way, whether it's success in business, you have a story about that, or in love or whatever. In other words, they create an exterior which other people, in fact, believe.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be murderers, they can be anything, but yet they can get away with it because people are willing to, the gullibility of people to simply accept the sort of socially supported view of what a virtuous, happy person looks like. And he then reveals the inside of those persons to discover that it's not very pretty in there.
No, if anything, it's like Dante. I mean, with all that implies, all the cruelty of the pit, but also all the sort of grotesque physical humor of sinners being turned upside down in their own excrement and so forth.
And there's a lot of excrement here, too, by the way. He tells the story of the dentist. And this is a dentist who, we find in the very first page of the story, has murdered a man because he was desperately in love with the man's fiancée. And he successfully murders the man and actually becomes a hero to the widowed fiancée because of his role he plays in determining that the man was strangled and sort of standing tall at the funeral and so forth. So they eventually get married. What happens then, Eric?
Okay, well, he goes out to have a wedding announcement printed. And by an error at the shop, there's a black border on the wedding announcements, as is customary for death notices. And this really makes him lose the composure that he's been projecting and relying on until then. And he starts to see things finally when his child is born with his wife. He sees the features of the man he murdered, a 30-year-old man's head on an infant, and he strangles his own son.
The importance of the black border is that it reminded him of the black border on the funeral and death announcement of the man he murdered. And then he couldn't get it out of his head, and he, which You then saw a picture of the deceased man that his wife still had, innocently, torn into pieces in front of her, and from that moment on, she couldn't get her former fiancé out of her head.
Yes, so it's always about these unexpected chains of cause and effect.
Psychic, and it's all psychic.
Yes, it's psychic, and I would say it's also spiritual, insofar as it's not just a matter of an obsession or a neurosis or a mistaken idea. It's really part of a higher reality intruding into the mental space of someone who has done wrong. So, in other words, what seems like a coincidental or accidental event, such as a misprint or a photograph that's lying around, actually has cosmic significance in terms of this person being made to acknowledge their sins.
Now, in the big picture of things, I'm talking with Eric Turner, translator of Léon Bois' Disagreeable Tales, and a forthcoming volume of Bois. Those of us who, and let's just take the Catholic crowd for a second, who try to remain current and knowledgeable of Catholic writers and great Catholic novels and so forth, how would you rank Bois? I'm sure you know who most people look to as the great Catholic writers. Where would you put Bois?
Well, I would put him up there at the top, simply because what he shows quite successfully, I think, are the eternal stakes of worldly actions. In other words, the lives we live down on Earth really are of utmost import, because they determine the life we will live or won't live in the hereafter. For that reason, I would say that he's really a neglected titan.
So you would recommend him alongside Graham Greene, J.F. Powers, Sigrid Undset, people like that?
I mean, if it's not presumptuous for me to do so, absolutely.
Well, let me tell you a story. Years ago, I got to know Cardinal John O'Connor pretty well, and I was sitting in his office one time, and we started talking about Catholic novels, and he said, well, my favorite is Bois, The Woman Who Was Poor. He said, I read it in French a couple of times. It's been a long time, okay? I didn't know Cardinal O'Connor read French. But anyway, he said, do you happen to have a copy of it in English? I'd like to reread it. And I sent him my precious copy of Bois' translation, The Woman Who Was Poor. And frankly, I had read it, but I didn't like it. The translation didn't grab me. Have you got any plans to retranslate it, The Woman Who Was Poor?
Well, I would jump at any opportunity to translate another book by Bois. Right now, no one's asked me to do that, and I have.
We'll talk offline about that. I think
okay. They
brought the Bois translation back into print, St. Augustine Press, which is great. But I really think it needs the kind of fluent translation that you could bring to it.
Oh,
and there's one other novel too. What's the other novel that Bois wrote?
He wrote. I'm trying to think of a good way to translate it. Le désespéré, the despairing man, which is not what I would call it if I had any opportunity to think about a more fitting title. But that is a largely autobiographical work.
That has not been translated into English.
Right, and there's also the Pilgrim of the Absolute. There's his journals, which are really just as gripping as as his works of fiction, because I mean he's really somebody who talked a big game, but he really not only did he talk the talk, he walked the walk.
Yeah, the translator, famous translator Richard Howard, once told me that the one person in French that really deserved to be translated and made better known was Bois.
Yeah, I think his influence is really profound too, just by and often by somewhat subterranean currents.
Well, you're helping into making it less subterranean. I'm glad you got a review in the Paris Review. I don't think it was a very good review. I'm going to write a much better one.
Oh,
and
I'm
going to bring all my Maritain background and stuff to it. But we've got only 5 minutes left. I often see Bois' name under the rubric of decadent Catholic or decadent. What does that? That's an off-putting thing, I would imagine, to the average Catholic reader.
Yeah,
should we not be put off? What does it mean?
Okay, well, yeah, and of course, you know, that same crime was perpetrated yet again by the Paris Review.
I noticed.
decadent is, of course, something that gets people's attention, and Bois certainly knew the power of, provocation himself. So in that sense, it isn't completely inappropriate to...
But decadence means more than provocation.
Yeah, but it's not accurate at all because, yeah, decadent implies weakness.
Yeah, moral weakness.
Sort of rottenness.
Yeah.
Especially of a moral sort. And what Bois was doing, if anything, was... there are many stories where he holds a mirror up to his, writer and artist contemporaries who are so blasé and decadent. And then he proceeds to give them the same treatment you've just...
Which made an enemy of many others. Friends of his.
Yeah, so he is really not decadent at all because unlike so many of his contemporaries, he didn't just kind of wallow in aestheticism and sensationalism. He might have used the same colors to paint his canvases, as it were, but what he gave form to was really very different because it actually sought to affirm precisely what had gone missing.
So he was kind of an anti-decadent decadent?
In the same way, for example, just as I mentioned him at the outset, in the same way that Nietzsche isn't really as nearly, at least the way I view him, as anti-Christian as he makes himself out to be.
Yes, I agree. I did my dissertation in part on Nietzsche, and there's lots that Christians can learn from Nietzsche. But of course, again, you face the same issue that sometimes the wrapper on a writer such as Bois doesn't seem very welcoming to people who are looking for something Christian or religious.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't I wouldn't recommend that anyone give their, adolescent kids a volume of Bois. When they're...
Well, there are some adolescents that probably could handle it, but they'd have to be, people who, young people who have dug through Tolstoy, and Nietzsche, and Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and found themselves in a world they comprehended.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's true. I think there's pits and snares that are easy to fall for, but if you stick with it, it becomes clear, I think, pretty quickly.
Yeah, your mind begins to understand the Bois universe as you go along through the stories. And, Eric Butler, I'm afraid we're just out of time now, and I want to take this last minute to remind everyone that the book is entitled Disagreeable Tales by Léon Bois. That's B-L-O-Y, published by Wakefield. please get this book. Please read it. And let's have Eric back on the show when the next volume of Ball comes out and when your book on the devil comes out, The Devil in Literature and Film. Thank you for being a guest on Church and Culture.
Thanks so much for having me.
And to all of you who are listening, we're going to have a short break now and come back with another very interesting guest.
Light of the East, weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, the Eastern Christian churches, both Catholic and Orthodox, face similar challenges of growth and survival. These challenges are best met by taking an honest look at the gifts of these churches.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Okay. What if he really doesn't understand why he's being disciplined? Well, that's a legitimate question. As a matter of fact, it's probably the dominant question in early disciplining. How much does a 16-month-old understand anyway? If he spits at you and you sit him on the steps, does he really understand why he shouldn't spit? No, he doesn't. All he knows is he's being sat on the step. He doesn't sit there and think, well, in any kind of socially reciprocal interaction, I think a mutual interface would be something that would be appropriate. Therefore, I can understand that magnitude of disrespect being a complete and total turnoff for my mother. No, all he knows is that mommy looked upset and put him on the steps and said, "You spit, you sit." If you had a dog, would you wait until the dog understood not to urinate on your carpet before you trained him not to urinate on your carpet? Oftentimes, in early discipline, when those kids are between 1 and 2 years of age and we are just starting to teach, if A, then B, they don't understand. In time, they'll come to understand. They will realize that certain behaviors have certain results. And with even more years, they will internalize the reasons for this. And those internal reasons will act as a self-regulating mechanism. But when we begin discipline, a good part of the time, if we ask the question, what if he doesn't understand? We can legitimately answer, I'm not sure he does. But that's okay. The teaching must begin. I'm Dr. Ray.
You remember the day you first laid eyes on her. They handed you the keys and you drove back home for everyone to admire. And although the memories have been made, it's time to pass the torch to someone else. Consider donating your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Even if it's not running, we'll take care of everything from pickup to your tax receipt. Just call 866-628-CARS to show you just how easy it is to donate. That's 866-628-CARS. And mention Ave Maria Radio.
Margaret Sanger is a saint in the feminist church. Liberals revere this woman who preached race improvement and denounced what she called human weeds and morons and idiots and imbeciles and the dead weight of human waste. Hillary Clinton glows that she is in awe of Sanger. She said so in 2009 upon receiving Planned Parenthood's highest honor, its coveted Margaret Sanger Award. Likewise effusive was Nancy Pelosi when she proudly accepted the award in 2014. Speaking to Planned Parenthood a year earlier, Barack Obama hailed the organization founded by this racial eugenicist committed to purging America's race of degenerates. "Thank you, Planned Parenthood," said Obama to a giddy crowd of women, "and God bless you." He commended Planned Parenthood's extraordinary and remarkable work and told the women they do a great, great job. And alas, no less than the Smithsonian, America's Museum, boasts a bust of Margaret Sanger. She's enshrined in its Struggle for Justice exhibit. That brings me to the reason for this commentary here today. A group of angry African-American pastors are demanding the removal of Sanger's bust from the Smithsonian. They accuse Sanger of a racist